A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about David Ben-Gurion, the person, not the monument. What kind of personality was he? What made him tick? And how does his vision of Zionism compare with what today's leadership rallies around? It's the kind of question that forces you to look past the bald head on the 100-shekel note and actually meet the man. And the timing matters, because the gap between Ben-Gurion Zionism and what's coming out of Jerusalem right now has never been wider.
He was a neurotic insomniac who read Plato in bed and wept at poetry. That's not the Ben-Gurion most people carry around in their heads. But his diaries, and I've spent time with the published volumes, reveal someone who was emotionally volatile in private and almost pathologically disciplined in public. He woke at 4 a.m. every day, read for 2 hours before anyone else was up, ate boiled vegetables because he considered food a distraction, and treated sleep as an inconvenience he resented.
Boiled vegetables and Plato at 4 a.m. The man turned self-denial into a political philosophy.
And that's where you have to start if you want to understand why his Zionism looked the way it did. The personality and the ideology weren't separate things. His statism, his pragmatism, his willingness to make decisions alone in the dark, all of it grew out of who he was as a person. Which is why this episode is really a dual portrait. Ben-Gurion, the man, versus Ben-Gurion, the symbol, and how that symbol has been claimed and weaponized by both left and right in ways that would probably baffle him.
The left waves him around as the founding socialist. The right invokes him as the hawk who declared statehood against all odds. Both are cherry-picking.
Both are cherry-picking. So let's establish the three pillars of his actual Zionism before we go any further. First, Mamlakhtiyut, statism, the belief that the state is the supreme instrument of Jewish self-determination and everything else is subordinate to it. Second, pragmatism over ideology. He was willing to compromise on territory, on economics, on religion, if it strengthened the state. And third, a secular Jewish identity as a national project, Judaism as a civilization and a peoplehood, not a religion. Those three pillars held up everything he built. And here's the tension worth sitting with. The same man who ordered the Altalena shell to establish the state's monopoly on force also gave up the Sinai for peace. Where does that flexibility live in today's leadership?
It doesn't. And that's the episode. But before we get there, I want to stay with the personality for a minute. Because for an audience that's probably more comfortable with engineering and organizational design than mid-century political history, there's actually something here worth stealing. Ben-Gurion's psychology reveals something about how you build institutions under existential pressure. His personality traits got baked into Israel's institutional DNA. Understanding him is almost like reading the source code.
And it's not a metaphor. The structures he built, the way decisions get made, the relationship between the military and civilian leadership, all of it traces back to his particular mind. So let's start with the personality that built the state. What made David Ben-Gurion tick?
You mentioned the diaries. What do they actually reveal?
The published volumes run to something like 15,000 pages. He wrote obsessively, every day, often late at night, after everyone else had gone to bed. And what emerges is someone who was hyper-rational in his decision-making, but emotionally volatile in his private life. He'd describe policy debates in granular detail. Who said what the vote count would be, what the Americans might do, and then on the same page he'd spiral into existential despair about whether the whole Zionist project was doomed. His wife Paula's letters, which have been studied extensively, paint a picture of a man who was emotionally absent, prone to depressive episodes, and who treated family as a distraction from destiny.
Destiny is a big word. Was this ego, ideology, or something else driving him?
I think it was conviction. But a very specific kind. He genuinely believed that Jewish history after the Holocaust had exactly one narrow window for sovereignty, and that if his generation failed to seize it, there wouldn't be another. That's not ego. That's a kind of terrible clarity. But it produced ego-like behavior because he stopped trusting anyone else's judgment. he developed what historians call the lonely decision-maker complex, the conviction that collective leadership was too slow, too cautious, too prone to compromise, and that history required a single will.
Which explains 1948. The Declaration of Statehood was a unilateral decision. He overrode his own cabinet, who wanted to wait.
May 14th, 1948, at 4 p.m., deliberately timed to avoid violating the Sabbath. He'd made the decision essentially alone. The vote in the Provisional State Council was 12 in favor, 10 opposed, and several abstentions. But he'd already written the declaration. The text was finalized hours before it was read, and he didn't consult the full council on the wording. He brought it to a small group the night before and pushed it through. That pattern repeats. The 1947 partition acceptance, the Altalena Order in June 1948, the 1952 reparations agreement with West Germany, all of them were Ben-Gurion deciding alone and then dragging the institutions along behind him.
The Altalena is the one that always stops me. 16 people died. He ordered the IDF to fire on a ship carrying arms for the Irgun, a Jewish militia, because the Irgun refused to hand the weapons over to the Unified State Military. That's a man willing to kill fellow Jews to establish a principle.
He never wavered on it. Years later, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that the cannon that shelled the Altalena deserved to be mounted in a museum as a sacred artifact because it established that there would be one state, one army, one authority. That's Mamlakhtiyut in its rawest form, no private militias, no parallel power structures. The state is everything, or it's nothing.
Which is a helpful bridge to his intellectual life, because that kind of clarity didn't come from nowhere. He read constantly. What was he actually reading?
He read an average of a book a day for most of his adult life, mostly history, philosophy, and biography. Spinoza was a lifelong obsession. He saw Spinoza as the first modern Jew, someone who broke with religious authority while preserving Jewish identity. He read Toynbee's A Study of History and argued with it in his diaries. Plato's Republic. Greek philosophy in translation. But here's the telling detail. He dismissed academic economists as what he called parlor talkers. He valued knowledge only as a tool for action. If it didn't help him build the state or win the next crisis, he wasn't interested.
He wasn't an intellectual for the sake of being an intellectual. He was an operator who read.
And that shaped Israel's applied science culture in ways that still echo. The Technion, the Weizmann Institute, the nuclear program at Dimona. All of that traces back to Ben-Gurion's conviction that Jewish sovereignty required technological self-sufficiency. He didn't care about pure research. He cared about what research could build. That's a very engineering mindset, and it's one reason Israel developed the way it did.
Let's talk about the personal cost. You mentioned Paula's letters.
Paula Ben-Gurion was a formidable person in her own right. She trained as a nurse, she was politically active, and she didn't hesitate to challenge him. But their marriage was strained by his near-total absorption in state-building. She once wrote that she felt like a widow to a living husband. He missed the births of his children. He was away for weeks at a time. When he was home, he was reading or writing. His daughter Renana has spoken about how he'd come to the dinner table, eat his boiled vegetables in silence, and return to his study. He wasn't cruel. By all accounts, he was gentle in his manner. But he was absent. The state was his real family.
That's a useful contrast with Netanyahu, who's built something closer to a family political dynasty. The luxury? The public displays of family life. The sons on social media.
The contrast is almost too neat to be true, but it's real. Ben-Gurion lived in a wooden hut at Kibbutz Deboker. He resigned as prime minister in 1953 and moved to the Negev Desert to work as a laborer. That was partly a political calculation. He wanted to inspire a movement to settle the Negev, but it was also genuine. He believed leaders should live simply. Netanyahu's lifestyle is the opposite, and it's not just a matter of taste. It reflects a fundamentally different understanding of what leadership is for. Ben-Gurion saw himself as an instrument of the state. Netanyahu, I think, sees the state as something closer to an extension of his own political survival.
You said before that Netanyahu's inability to admit error is a strategic worldview, not just ego. How does that play into the comparison?
Ben-Gurion made catastrophic errors and admitted them. After the 1954 Levant affair, a botched Israeli intelligence operation in Egypt, he initially defended the military leadership, then reversed himself and spent years fighting to expose what really happened. It cost him politically. He alienated his own party. But he couldn't let it go, because the principle of civilian control over the military mattered more to him than his career. Netanyahu doesn't operate that way. Error admission is weakness. Loyalty is everything. The difference isn't just personality. It's a different theory of power.
Let's move to the second act. That personality didn't just shape a man. It shaped a nation's institutions. And those institutions are now being tested by a very different kind of leader.
So let's get concrete about what Ben-Gurion Zionism actually was, because this is where most of the misconceptions live. First one, Ben-Gurion was not a socialist. He used socialist rhetoric to mobilize the kibbutzim and the labor unions, but his economic policies were pragmatic and shifted rightward after 1952. The reparations agreement with West Germany was the turning point. He accepted money from the country that had murdered 6 million Jews because the state needed capital to survive. That's not ideological socialism. That's ruthless pragmatism.
The reparations debate is worth pausing on, because it's almost unthinkable today. He negotiated the terms in secret, brought it to the Knesset, and faced a no-confidence vote while a crowd outside threw stones at the building. Someone threw a bomb into the chamber. He pushed it through anyway, because the alternative was economic collapse.
$600 million over 12 years. That's about $7 billion in today's money. It built Israel's infrastructure. The national water carrier, the ports, the electrical grid, all of it was funded in part by reparations money. And he took the political hit because the state needed it. Survival trumped emotion. That's the core of Ben-Gurion Zionism. The state is the goal, and everything else, territory, ideology, religious sentiment, even justice, is instrumental.
Which brings us to territory. Because the second big misconception is that he was a hawk who wanted all of historic Israel.
He accepted partition twice, in 1937 with the Peel Commission proposal, and in 1947 with the UN plan. Both times he gave up Judea and Samaria. In 1948, he made the deliberate decision not to capture the West Bank, even though the Jordanian army was weak and the territory was within reach. He prioritized state consolidation over territorial expansion. And after 1967, when he was retired, he wrote a letter to the government arguing that Israel should return almost all of the captured territories except Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. His exact warning was that ruling over Palestinians would corrode the Jewish character of the state.
That letter is from June 1967. He saw the problem immediately.
While everyone else was celebrating the victory, he was writing memos about demographic disaster. He understood that governing millions of stateless Palestinians would either turn Israel into an apartheid state or a binational state, and both outcomes were incompatible with the Jewish sovereignty he'd spent his life building. That's not a left-wing position, that's a statist position. The state required a Jewish majority, and holding the territories endangered that majority.
Let's contrast that with today. Netanyahu's Zionism, and especially the Zionism of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, is fundamentally different. How would you characterize the shift?
Ben-Gurion Zionism was instrumental and flexible because the state was the goal. Today's Zionism is ideological and territorial. The land is the goal. That's the central shift. And it changes everything about policy. Ben-Gurion made the 1947 status quo deal with the Orthodox parties, giving them control over marriage, divorce, and education, because he needed political unity to declare the state. He saw it as a temporary compromise. He once said the rabbinate would fade away once the state was secure. Today's religious Zionist leadership treats that same status quo deal as a launching pad for halachic statehood. Smotrich's decisive plan from 2023 explicitly calls for applying Jewish law to civil governance in the West Bank.
Ben-Gvir's Otzma Yehudit party goes further. It rejects the state's authority over Jewish law entirely in some areas. The man who shelled the Altalena to establish a state monopoly on force would have something to say about that.
He'd have more than something to say. He'd see it as a direct assault on Mamlachtiyut. The whole point of the Altalena was that no group gets to have its own army, its own law, its own authority outside the state. And now you have coalition partners who openly advocate for parallel religious authority. That's not a policy disagreement. That's a rejection of the founding principle.
Let's talk about the judicial overhaul, the 2023 attempt to weaken the courts, and the ongoing efforts since then are aimed at institutions Ben-Gurion built as pillars of statism.
the Supreme Court, the Civil Service, the Attorney General's Office. These are Ben-Gurion's institutions. He established them as checks on political power, not because he loved checks and balances as an abstract principle, but because he understood that a state needs stable institutions that outlast individual leaders. The current coalition sees those same institutions as obstacles to be dismantled. That's a direct inversion of Memlakhtiyut. Ben-Gurion wanted strong institutions that constrain leaders. Today's leadership wants weak institutions that leaders can override.
There's also a demographic argument that shifted. Ben-Gurion's ingathering of exiles was driven by a fear of Jewish extinction after the Holocaust. He needed bodies, people, a critical mass of Jews in one place. Today's leadership uses demographic arguments to justify annexation.
The West Bank has about 2.7 million Palestinians. Annexing Area C, which is the current coalition plan, would either give them citizenship and end the Jewish majority, or deny them citizenship and formalize apartheid. Ben-Gurion saw this coming in 1967. His solution was to return the territories. The current leadership's solution is to pretend the demographic problem doesn't exist, or to argue that it can be managed through fragmented autonomy that never becomes statehood. That's a bet Ben-Gurion would never have taken. He was too clear-eyed about numbers.
You mentioned his 1953 resignation to Stabokor earlier. I want to dwell on that, because it's such a strange move. The Prime Minister quits and goes to work on a kibbutz in the desert. What was the actual calculation?
It was strategic patience in its purest form. He was exhausted, he said so openly, but he also knew that his party was fracturing and that his authority was waning. So he removed himself, let the fractures widen without him in the middle of them, and waited. 2 years later, he came back as defense minister under Moshe Sharet, and by the end of 1955, he was prime minister again with more authority than before. He called Stabokor his listening post. He read, he wrote, he worked the fields, and he watched the political situation deteriorate until the country asked him to return.
That's a level of patience that's almost alien to modern politics. Nobody steps down voluntarily anymore.
He's the only Israeli prime minister who ever did it. He resigned in 1963 as well, citing exhaustion and a desire to write his memoirs. Every other prime minister has either lost an election, been forced out by scandal, or died in office. Ben-Gurion walked away twice. He believed leaders should know when to leave. That's not a small difference from the current era, where political survival is the entire game.
Let's talk about his limitations as an orator, because there's a misconception there too. People assume the Founding Father must have been a great speaker.
He was terrible. Stiff, monotone, prone to long pauses. He read his speeches from prepared texts and rarely deviated. He had no charisma in the conventional sense. He wasn't a Churchill or a Kennedy. His power was entirely behind the scenes. He built coalitions, he wrote the strategy, he made the decisions, and then he sent others out to sell them. Moshe Dayan and Shimon Peres were his public faces in many ways. Ben-Gurion was the operator in the back room.
Which makes the contrast with today's populist anti-elitism even sharper. Netanyahu is a gifted communicator in both Hebrew and English. Ben-Gvir is a professional agitator who thrives on social media. Smotrich is a polished debater. The current leadership is media savvy in a way Ben-Gurion never was, and probably never wanted to be.
Ben-Gurion was intellectually curious in a way that today's leadership often explicitly rejects. He read Toynbee and Spinoza. He corresponded with philosophers. He wrote essays about the meaning of Jewish history. The current coalition includes ministers who boast about not reading the news. The anti-intellectualism is a feature, not a bug. It's part of the populist appeal. Ben-Gurion would have found that incomprehensible. For him, knowledge was power. For today's leadership, knowledge is suspect.
Where does this leave us? If Ben-Gurion's Zionism was about building a state, and today's is about holding territory, what does that mean for the next generation?
It means the institutional culture Ben-Gurion built is being actively dismantled by people who invoke his name while rejecting his principles. And that's not just a historical curiosity. It has real consequences for governance, for security, for Israel's relationship with the diaspora, and for the Palestinians who live under occupation. The question isn't whether Ben-Gurion was right about everything. He wasn't. The question is whether the shift from statism to territorialism produces a state that's more stable or less stable, more democratic or less democratic, more Jewish or less Jewish in the sense he cared about.
Let me pull out something actionable for the audience, because this isn't just a history lesson. Ben-Gurion's model of leadership, deep intellectual preparation combined with ruthless pragmatism, has lessons for anyone building an organization under existential pressure. He read a book a day. He made decisions alone when speed mattered. He compromised on everything except the survival of the enterprise. That's a template, and it has obvious downsides. Brittleness, burnout, the loneliness you mentioned. But it also has advantages in clarity and speed.
His lonely decision-maker approach is both his greatest gift to Israeli political culture and its most dangerous inheritance. It created a system where prime ministers feel entitled to make existential decisions without broad consensus. That works when the leader is Ben-Gurion. It works less well when the leader isn't. And the institutional guardrails he built, the courts, the civil service, the professional military, were supposed to compensate for that. Weakening those guardrails while keeping the unilateral decision-making culture is a recipe for disaster.
There is a question underneath all of this that I think is worth surfacing explicitly. Can Zionism survive without Ben-Gurion's pragmatism? The current trajectory, permanent occupation, religious nationalism, weakened institutions, may produce a state that Ben-Gurion would not recognize. And that state may be less stable, less democratic, and less capable of the kind of flexible response to crisis that he made the center of his strategy.
I think that's the right question, and the way to start answering it is to go back to primary sources. Read Ben-Gurion's 1953 essay, The Imperatives of the Jewish Revolution. It's his clearest statement of what the state is for. Then read Netanyahu's 2009 Bar Ilan speech, where he endorsed a two-state solution in principle, but with conditions that made it impossible. Then read Smotrich's decisive plan from 2023, which rejects Palestinian statehood entirely and calls for annexation. The ideological distance between those three documents is measurable. You can track the shift in real time.
What would you recommend to someone who wants to understand Ben-Gurion the person, not just the political figure?
His diaries are the best window. The published selections are available in English. Ben-Gurion, A Political Life, is a good starting point. Paula's letters have been collected too, and they're devastating in their own way. You see the private man, the cost of his single-mindedness, the depressive episodes, the loneliness. And then read something by someone who worked with him closely. Moshe Dayan's memoirs, or Shimon Peres's accounts of the early years. Peres worshipped Ben-Gurion and still described him as essentially unknowable.
Unknowable is a good word. I think that's part of why he remains so contested as a symbol. Everyone projects onto him whatever they need him to be. The left projects the socialist visionary. The right projects the hawk who declared statehood against the world. The religious Zionists project the man who made the status quo deal with the rabbinate. And all of those projections are partial. The real Ben-Gurion was more complicated and less usable.
He was a secular ascetic who made a deal with orthodox parties he privately disdained. A socialist in rhetoric and a pragmatist in policy. A hawk who warned against holding territory. A democrat who made unilateral decisions. A man who built institutions and then spent his final years fighting the party he created. The contradictions aren't bugs, they're the whole story.
Which brings us to the question we'll leave you with. A question Ben-Gurion himself might have asked. Was he a visionary who built a state that outgrew his ideology? Or a flawed pragmatist whose compromises sowed the seeds of today's crises?
The related question, as Israel approaches its 80th year in 2028, the tension between Ben-Gurion's statist Zionism and the new territorial religious Zionism will define the next decade. The personality of the leader matters less than the institutional culture they leave behind. Ben-Gurion left institutions. What will this era leave?
One final thought experiment. What would Ben-Gurion make of a government that includes a party whose platform explicitly rejects the state's authority over Jewish law? The man who shelled the Altalena to assert the state's monopoly on force. What would he do with ministers who argue that divine law overrides the Supreme Court?
I think we know the answer. He'd see it as a direct challenge to the principle he spent his life establishing, and he wouldn't be gentle about it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, the Italian statistician Bruno de Finetti developed a radical theory of probability while working for an insurance company in Trieste on the Adriatic coast of the Caspian Basin. He argued that probability doesn't exist in the world at all. It's purely a measure of human ignorance. He called this position subjective Bayesianism, and it so infuriated the frequentist establishment that his papers were rejected from major journals for over a decade. The paradox at the heart of his work, that we can rationally update our beliefs about events that have no objective probability, still divides statisticians today.
Of course, there are probability wars.
Subjective Bayesianism as a career-limiting move.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the fact and the production. If you want to understand Israel's current identity war, start with the man who built the arena. Read Ben-Gurion's own words, then read what today's leaders are writing. The Gap tells the story. Find us at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.